Ciao, benvenuti, welcome to Choc Tops and Cassata, the podcast that takes a peek into the way migrants got their fix of Italian movies from World War II to the advent of SBS in the early 80s.
This is a Secret Life of Language podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Elisabetta Ferrari, lecturer in Italian Studies at the University of Melbourne.
I'm Mark Nichols. I research and teach in film in the School of Culture and Communications at the University of Melbourne.
And I'm Santo Cilauro. I'm not a lecturer in anything. I'm a writer, I'm a filmmaker, and an unashamed connoisseur of all Italian B-grade movies, regardless of where they were made. Sicily, Calabria, or way up north in Naples.
Santo, Mark and I have been thinking about something that you said during one of the podcasts.
Was it an outrageous statement?
I know. And I said the Spanish Inquisition is here now. And so we want to talk about this idea of The Castle being an Italian film.
Oh, did I say that? Did I?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you sure?
You totally will.
Absolutely.
We can get Gavin to wind the tape back and tell
us. Actually, we will, you know.
So I co-wrote a film called The Castle, yeah. And to me, it's a very Italian film.
Yes.
People say it's the most quintessentially Australian yeah. film I can think of. And I sit there and go, isn't that funny? Because I think of it as the opposite. Yeah. I think of it as a very Italian film.
Yeah.
Wow. And I guess I said it earnestly. Did I say it seriously? It wasn't flippant. No, you know what? I did say it. I've often thought it. I accept that it's a slightly strange thing to say because it's like saying it's like Italian food, but what specifically in Italian food? What kind of Italian film is it like? Is it like a Fellini film? Definitely not. I think I said it. It's to me, it's a very Italian film because of the Italian films that I saw. So in the same way that a lot of things that I write are very influenced by Elvis Presley or Jerry Lewis or the wrestling, because that's what I saw. So when I talk about The Castle being a very Italian film, I think it's a very Italian film according to the Italian films that I saw at the time, which were usually about family. It was always set either in their home, in their apartment or in their country home or whatever it is. And it was usually pretty simple. It was like a fable. And it usually started off with once upon a time and ended with, and they lived happily ever after. Now, I'm sure there's lots of films in all sorts of languages and cultures that are the same as that. But I always thought that The Castle reminded me of Italian films.
That's really interesting because actually when you said that, I actually didn't think about Italian films. I thought about films about Italians, but which we could get onto. But mm-hmm. I wonder whether we unpack this idea a little bit about what are the sort of films that it looks like, because that seems to me to tap into exactly what we're talking about on this podcast is those films that you saw in Clifton Hill when you were a kid and whether that was the point of contact with what came out
yes.
from your part.
And I think that it is as a starting point, but I'd love to be talked out of it. I'd like to know if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we can demonstrate how Australian it is, this film. For me.
Is that what I'm doing? Yeah. Am I the token skip again in this conversation?
I know. And I'm the Italian here. Yeah. But as I was rewatching it, I'm thinking there are a few elements that are absolutely so Australian, and it's very difficult for me to see it as an Italian film. But then again, I can understand this idea of the inspiration, what were the formative films mm-hmm. for your career. And also there is an element that I have to admit that is a little bit about a kind of almost nostalgia about a certain idea of identity or community or life that comes out of the film.
I just think that at the very heart of it, there's an unconditional love that exists there that doesn't really exist in films that are Anglo-Saxon-y kind of films. That underlying unconditional love, no matter what it is, and you keep undercutting it. There's people in jail. They do illegal things. They steal gates. There's all sorts of things that are immoral in society. But at the same time, underpinning everything is just this love for each other, no matter what. The brothers love each other. and they'll go visit each other in jail every week, whatever it is. The dad loves the daughter and wants her to, you know, he thinks she's destined for very big things because she's such a good hairdresser. It's just this absolute faith that I seem to grow up with those kind of films, where those Italian films. I wish I could say which ones they were, but they're so embedded in my memory. So I haven't even seen, I saw as a kid the Alberto Sordi and Claudio Cardinale one, the one they shot in Australia, the
Si cerca. Bello Nesto, Emigrante.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the benefit of the non-Italian listeners, in English, it's called Girl in Australia.
Girl in Australia, yeah. Really?
That's right.
But to me, would have been a much easier title, even in Italian.
But to me, but that's the kind of film I think I'm talking about. It's not Fellini. It's not, you know, complete. It's not a takeoff of a Ben-Hur kind of movie. It's these, their heart is in the right place kind of movies.
Yeah.
And I love those movies.
A good friend and I had a debate recently about the film. And we were talking about when Daryl's all proud of his daughter, played by Sophie Lee, because she got a certificate from a TAFE. Mm. And my friend was saying, oh, isn't that a bit like classist and talking down? I said, no, I don't think you get it. Like, I think it's about the warmth of that. And, you know, you can think, your kid can do the most ridiculously sort of mundane thing, but as a parent, you can be proud of anything, whether they got a PhD from Oxford or a certificate from, you know, a college in TAFE. And that, to me, is interesting about how it addresses issues of class in a way. But I disagreed with my friend, thinking that it's much more positive and more community and more kind of collegial or something. As I've often seen this kind of humour upset middle-class people because they think there's a sort of a talking down to. And I mean, obviously, you
wouldn't agree with that. Well, we felt bulletproof because it was based on stories of our own families. So we had no fear of that at all. So our approach was just be unashamed. You know what I mean? No man is a hypocrite in his own pleasure. So this is what they do. This is them. Mm. And I'm not going to be half-cocked about it. Yeah. That's how they love each other.
Yeah.
And he's proud that she's got... I don't care whether you perceive it as as being patronizing. It's possibly more of a reflection on you. You know, you're proud of your own kids.
Yes.
You're proud of what they do,
yes.
No matter what. And you know, and Daryl in the film, he actually says with his son Wayne, who's in prison, you know, maybe I could have done better.
Mm.
Maybe I could have done better. That's all you need to say.
Yeah.
He questions that. He questions that, but he knows his son's going to come out. In fact, that's what one of the main gripes that he's got with leaving home is that his son's going to come out of prison and not go back to his home.
Yes.
So in that sense, going back to the Italianness of it, the films that I saw, the Italian films that I saw were very, they stand and deliver. They were not ashamed. They just told the story the way it is. And you either like the story or you don't like the story. You like the characters or you don't like the characters. There's no sense of apology or being, you know, approaching with, you know, sort of baby steps.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that in that way really connects with those films that came out in Italy, you know, in the 60s, in the 70s. And that, to me, there is a little bit of a Commedia Italiana in The Castle, I have to say, but... in a different way, as you're saying, you know, there is almost like a fairy tale, you know, you start and then there is a happily ever after at the end, whereas the Commedia Italiana certainly doesn't have that. So I always thought that in a way is a very strong difference in between the Commedia Italiana and or the comedy Italian style and a film like The Castle, whereas the comedy Italian style can be really harsh, really strong in the critique and in the satire of that particular society. And so Italians will go and watch the film, you laugh, but you think, oh, you see yourself, but you can see that there is a critique and a very strong critique. Whereas in this film, there is a sense of warmth towards, I think, the characters.
Oh, yeah. Before we even set up the jokes, we set up the warmth of the characters. The even the son telling the story. We chose a 14-year-old boy or 13-year-old boy, whatever, in because it's a time, it's before you're being rebellious to your parents, or maybe you're just starting or whatever it is, but you still think your dad is a hero. You know, no matter what, you know, even when he comes back with stories about the cars that he's been working with in the, you go, wow, it's incredible. Mm. He's a tow truck driver. He's incredible what he does. So there's an innocence and there's a love right from the very start. The one thing that I should probably ask you about this, Elizabeth, and that is the film played very big in Australia and it played very big in Ireland, okay? So, and I'm just trying to think of the characteristics, which is certainly in this country, and I presume we get it from Ireland, and that is the distrust of the big guy versus small guy. So you look at in Italy, I get a different sense. So when you look at somebody walking down Via Veneto in a fur coat, Italian will say, you got to hand it to him, he's doing well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas here, you go, wanker.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
So that to me, I'm not sure whether I'm arguing against myself here that it maybe is not as Italian as I think, because this whole small guy versus the big guy, it must be a universal theme, but is it that big in Italy? I mean, with Totò and films like that, was it always that the underdog tries to get it over the big guy?
Yeah, I think that in the Italian culture is quite different, this idea of the aspiration of being at the top and being important. But also there is quite a sense of the class that, you are in. And you don't find it, I think, as much in the castle. And it's quite interesting because when he goes to court and he sees the QC, he's playing down on what he does. He says, oh, maybe I can help you. Oh, yes, you know. And it's really very interesting how he is actually playing down the level of his work and what he can do, and he's happy too.
Yeah.
So it's quite difficult to see the difference in class there.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's no he's actually playing down the difference in class that is possibly. I can imagine if that was an Italian film, that's a nuance that you would not see.
No,
Someone actually saying, I've got a little bit of experience and.
Yeah. Or even the naivety, of him thinking, oh, well, he's just another lawyer and he's just here and maybe helping his son that, or someone that is in trouble. So there is a naivety that it's really sweet. And I think that usually you don't find that in Italian films.
If that was an Italian film, the QC would say, hey, my name is Dr. Mark Nichols.
And the other person would say, we're really playing with the different levels in society.
But it's also, don't brag about yourself. I mean,
this is exactly the opposite of what's happening, in Italy, where everyone would just introduce themselves as a dottore, commendatore, and
in fact,
you name
correct
it.
Me if I'm wrong, Elisabetta, isn't, don't Italians say that reserve or is it flemma? What's the word for to be reserved?
To be reserved.
Flemma? Yeah, you can use a flemma or.
But they say the flemma is, it's a British trait.
To be reserved, I would think so.
A British trait.
Yeah, I think that Italians like very much, Italians to use their titles and to assert who they are, and they're very in tune of all of the reference,
there's
levels.
There's an interview with your colleague who worked on the film, Jane Kennedy, and she says in her childhood, the worst crime was to be up yourself.
Yes. Oh, and she comes from a strong Irish family.
I think the Irish thing is really interesting, that sense of, and particularly where Eric Banner, one, he says, I've got to say I've got problems with the legal system. And then later on he says, it's restored my faith in
the legal system.
That kind of thing about, I can see why it's popular in Ireland, put it that way. Yeah,
yes.
That whole idea is don't be up yourself and have a go at those who are up themselves and be suspicious of authority.
Yes. And I guess I'm just wondering that same family in Italy, would they be a lot more, not cunning, but they're streetwise. There'd be an element of street wisdom as opposed to that idealism of, I've got this, it's all sorted, I've got this right.
Yeah. And I think that is that element that the Italian define as furbizia,
furbizia,
being furbo, which is very difficult to translate.
Furbo.
It's very difficult to translate because it really means to be cunning and wise at the same time.
Yes.
You know, so
dodgy.
And dodgy as well.
In many cases, Daryl Kerrigan is that. You know, he does do things. You know, he doesn't get council approval for, you know, the aerials and, you know, he does steal gay. He you know, there's a reference to it. Even, I think, Dennis DeNudo, he said something like, he actually has a go. In the court case, he says, got a pretty good set of gates. As
right.
You stole the gates, though, didn't
exactly.
you?
Exactly, yeah.
We did everything by the law, with the law. I didn't tell him about the gates.
Gates.
I think,
But I think it's the way he does it in a very open and naive way. He's not trying, you know, to... I mean, he is, you know, going against the law, but he still has got faith, you know, in law, because he will think, well, you know, this is going to be my right. I'm going to, you know, contest it.
This takes us to a very, it's interesting that you actually said that. He's got faith in the law because, I don't know whether I've told you guys, but the film was going to be made in Italian. There was going to be an Italian version of it, and it was going very well. I was having a very good relationship with the writer, the person who was adapting it, and there was a fork in the path. And after I said, you can't go that way. That's changing the story too much. He never spoke to me again.
He got offended.
And
Do you remember what the fork was? You've just brought it up.
Yeah.
He didn't want the Kerrigans to go through the court system.
Okay. That's quite interesting. No.
He said, we don't go to any courts. We don't end up in the high court. That just would not happen in Italy.
No.
It just would not happen in Italy. And he wanted to resolve it on television shows.
On
variety shows where you get people behind you and they start. And I said, I love the idea, but it can only work when it's a legitimate. The family has to win in a community legitimate, in a societal legitimate way. They can't take any shortcuts. They have to win, absolutely. They have to win. The law has to look at them and say, no, you're right. That's the vibe of the law. Otherwise, it's counterproductive. It's like you're never going to win against the law, which these Italian guys were saying.
Yeah.
And they're true. But I'm saying that's when you're departing from the whole fable of the story.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I know that it's not true. It wouldn't happen in Australia.
You get a high court date in 3 weeks.
I know. But maybe in Australia you will get it in, I don't know.
Years?
A year. And in Italy you will get it in 20 years. I don't know. But maybe that in Italian is very too far-fetched.
Is the thing about Daryl and his family is that they have no sense of bella figura. They don't care what other people...
Absolutely.
Now, I'm not saying that is an Italian thing. It's an Italian concept, but...
I know plenty of people
who are Italian who have no care about that either. But it is out there as a kind of an idea. And Daryl, you know, they love living in that... we're going to Bonnie Doon.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and there's no self-consciousness because I think they're all kind of heroes and they don't care whether... Or do they not even know?
Maybe it's the opposite of what you're saying, Mark. Maybe that is, in their minds, that is bella figura. My home at Bonnie Doon, it's not a caravan. It's a holiday home. Did he say it's not a tent? It's not a caravan. It's not a camper. Yeah. It's a house.
Yeah.
So that is the bella figura, and also what his bella figura is actually even more altruistic. It's very Don Quixote in the sense that he has got morals. And in fact, his wife Sal, when she tells the story about when she used to go out on a date with her ex-boyfriend, she points out, but I like this guy because he had morals. He had morals.
Right.
I don't know whether maybe you are right. Maybe bella figura, it doesn't matter about bella figura. It's about being honest to your ideals and to be loyal to your family and to your friends. Mm. And there are so many shows now, like Yellowstone is based on not losing your home. You're hanging on to your home is sacrosanct. You can't take that away.
Mm.
And it's funny because a lot of, a lot of accidental things have happened to a lot of working dog works over the years, and the, different meanings get ascribed to what we do. So, and one of them for the castle was that it's a metaphor for Indigenous land rights in this country, which I can assure you we didn't write for that. But it often happens that you accidentally come across something. So it is deeply embedded in, no, this is my right. This is my home, and I don't care what you say about it, how bad you think it looks, whether there's a plane flying overhead, whether there's lead in the soil. It's my home and you just can't touch that. Now, and that overrides everything. But I'm not sure whether that's a moral bella figura.
I think that bella figura is a very complex kind of, cultural idea, because it's not just about how you show yourself, but it's being very, very aware of how other people see you. And so what you have, you're very conscious. I mean, in this idea of bella figura, if you're, in Italy, you would be very aware of what is your level and what you are displaying, or what, you are wearing and what you are saying, and how is that perceived by others. Whereas I think in the film, really, there is like an acceptance, a total acceptance of the level of, what they have and what they can display or show, and there is an acceptance of that. Whereas I think in an Italian view, you always maybe you think that you might have to show that you are more than what you are.
Don't forget, I mean, Daryl Kerrigan has a pool room where he displays all these things. Now, so he is displaying them. You know what I mean? He's not just he's not just accepting his stuff, which he loves.
Yeah.
He not only accepts them, he wants to show them that they are to be shown off. So there is a sense of that.
Sense of pride of what he has achieved.
Pride in what people have given him. So he stares at his daughter's TAFE certificate. He stares at it.
Yeah.
And he stares at power lines. He stares at anything which he thinks are awesome.
Yeah.
Is awesome.
To me, the pool room makes me think of the Barocca lounge with the plastic still on it. You know, that's not even coming out of the the package.
No.
Exactly.
Because we don't want to get it dirty. There's something about that.
And I have to tell you, the people that actually lent us the house, that when we said, well, don't worry, we'll get it back to how it was before, they said, no, we love this wallpaper. And a lot of the house stayed exactly the same as when we, and it's been moved now to a different place. I think it's a museum or something somewhere, and it's been transported somewhere else.
Well, that's certainly an element that is so Australian. When I watch this film, I think there's something about in the house, in the decor, that to me, it just says Australia.
Yes.
Not to mention in the garden that there is, that contraption that is an Australian thing, the hills hoist.
Hills hoist, yeah. Well, you've got comedy, you've got to have a hills hoist.
It's
a
spot.
Well, no, all films. I'm starting to think that when you go through, Screen Victoria or, the Screen Commission, and you're asking for funding, there must be a little box it says it's an Australian film, has to show and hill hoist, otherwise you don't get any funding.
Here's a bonus to the bonus episode. My father-in-law tried to sell hills hoists in Italy and almost went broke.
I tell you,
did not work in Italy at all. He thought they were the best thing here, and he said, oh my God, these hills are, no one's got them in Italy, one at all.
Absolutely. I'll tell you a funny story. When I moved to Australia, I was living in Adelaide, and I just arrived in Australia, and my parents came to visit. And clearly, we had a house in the background, you could see the neighbours with a hill hoist in the middle of their garden. We didn't have one, but the neighbours did. And one morning, my parents had just arrived, I could see and hear them in the kitchen, and my mom calling my dad saying, hey, come and have a look. I was, what? Look at that contraption. What's that? And they are laughing and think, what's that? I don't know. What is it? And then, it's got clothes hanging on there, And then, a little bit of wind arrives and they start to move around. And they are, they are laughing, saying, I like it. Turns around, and they could not believe that you would have, first of all, something like that in the middle of your backyard, and secondly, that you would put clothes which my mom rightly so said, look, they are in the sun, they are going to, you know, all of the colors, they are going to fade, all of the whites are going to become yellow. That's not really useful. So there you are. So it's not.
That's why, yeah.
I've got to say, talking about Hills Hoists, talking about stuff in the Kerrigan garden, in the house, I don't know why we're not saying this isn't a Fellini film. I mean, the imagery is, when think about the Hills Hoist, that to me could be totally in the last scene of Otto Mezzo.
Yeah.
The surrealist thing, I think, is there's a lot of that, you know, at it from an outsider point of view and think, that's pretty weird. Not something, you know, like, okay, so he's sitting in the back garden at the end of the thing and he's finally got his patio, but he's done it Greek style. Like,
there is an absurdity to it all, yes.
Well, not to mention what they wear. I mean, some of their outfits are just hilarious. And there is one with kangaroos that I think that same as Hills Hoist.
That's
you
the
know,
sort of kitsch thing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But that idea of Australian film, that you have to have the two elements. But also, can we talk about the food, you know?
Oh, right. Yeah, not very Italian.
I have seen this film so many times, but I watched it again last night to prepare for our discussion. And the one thing I noticed last night that I'd never seen before is, you know, he says, oh, what's this? It's really nice. And she goes, that's chicken. And then one of the boys grabs the tomato sauce and pours it all over. Beautiful.
Having actually had dinner many a time at the Sitch family house, Charlie Sitch, the dad, would compliment the mum no end. And, you know, Robert turned around going, what is he? I mean, really, is he to be complimented on really simple stuff is beautiful. But at the same time, it is funny because that's intended to be that, as in, really, is it really all that special? I don't think it actually is. Because I think Rob still talks about his aunt. He goes, oh, Auntie Jean's risotto. Oh, my God. And he said he came around to a barbecue at my father-in-law's place once and he said, oh, my God, that's food. That's food, not that other stuff. But to compliment you on that stuff is fantastic, isn't it?
Mm. Oh, no, it's really sweet.
It's so
really,
good.
Really.
And the importance of it.
Yeah. And I mean, that regards, maybe that's where I find more the Italian, you know, this idea that family really always unites, around the table and have a dinner together.
I initially said that it's an Italian film. Maybe I'm a bit biased because I was there for the writing of it and the production of it, which probably reminds me of how Italian films were made in the early days.
Interesting.
And necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
The other day I said to my dad, oh, isn't it great that you ate a lot of chicory when you were... He goes, that's all we had. So you're sitting there saying, isn't it great that neorealist films were shot so gritty? And they're just saying, well... You tell me another way for me to have shot it.
Yeah.
I know that I don't know whether we've spoken, Mark, before about the Zeffirelli claiming that neorealism was created because that was stolen stock from.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories about with Città Aperta, open city, and how they stole power from the American embassies and they stole footage from film stock from you know whatever was around, and there's a lot of put together. I think some of those things are a bit mythological, but I think they represent, I mean, what I think, and I'm really glad you've taken into this direction, the idea that the kind of guerrilla style filmmaking, and, you know, I wouldn't exactly say that this is guerrilla style filmmaking.
But
the way that the production conditions contribute to how we read the film and how we interpret the film, you know, and what's happening behind the camera, what's happening in pre-production, in post, and those sorts of things, I think, to me, that's an interesting way of thinking about this in that kind of context.
Well, you can clearly tell that there are Italian films where there's a conversation going on and there are no reverses. It's just two people talking to each other. Clearly, they weren't going to shoot reverse shots.
Yeah.
They just said, we can't double the filming here. We just do it fast.
Mm.
You know, do it fast. So we certainly did that. We could only afford 180 minutes worth of film, and I remember coming back from the Kodak factory and I've said it, you know, and guys, we can do it if we just don't do it in more than two takes. It's as simple as that. And let's write it simply.
It was almost one-to-one, wasn't it? We've talked about this before.
But it was somewhere between one-to-one and two-to-one. We certainly didn't need two takes all the time.
Yeah, so just to clarify that you know, one-to-one or one-to-two is really quite rare in contemporary filmmaking because so many things can go wrong, hair in the gate, everything. And also, I think if you don't mind me, you know, we've talked about this before, about its relationship to the making of the dish, and that kind of dynamic, I think, is perhaps worth exploring.
Well, that's such a different, that's so different. You know, we actually got a proper cinematographer, and we know we wanted to make that film look the way it actually ended up looking like. Mm. Whereas we wanted the castle to look like a storybook. It needed to turn pages. In fact, I think the film starts off with a montage for quite a long time, and the proper scenes really start when there was a knock at the door to change all that, and then there were scenes. Before that, there was just bits of montage. Yeah. And it ends quite early on. It actually ends with and Dad and Mr. Hamill and Dennis Tenuto went to the High Court of Australia. I don't think there are any scenes after that. They basically roll up at the High Court. They look up, and then the rest are in bits and pieces. Dad reckons that blah, blah, the QC was like a greyhound at the track. And then we had a party, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then they all lived happily ever after. So it was a very simple film in that sense, because we knew we couldn't overshoot it. It had to be done like that. Whereas The Dish clearly wasn't. It had to be constructed properly. You know, we had two units. We had a, you know, first unit, a second unit to do all the outside stuff. So it was more complex. But so in that sense, going back to it, I think it maybe was like an Italian. I mean, when I read about those Swords and Sandals movies that were made in Rome in the 50s and 60s, they were basically out of work stunt people who just said, what are we going to do? You change your name to Heston Charles. There was a guy called Heston Charles who played basically what Charlton Heston always used to play in those films. And he would have been a stunt person or a fill-in or something like that. And they just created their films that way. They just would make them up almost as they went along. And they're the kind of films that I saw. So maybe my assessment of it as an Italian film is maybe tinged a bit, knowing that it was made in that way.
Why did you make the film?
Well, this is a really odd thing. It's because we wanted to make The Dish. We had written The Dish, and we had then presented it to our distributors who had been distributing our shows. We were doing a show called Frontline at the time on the ABC. They were film distributors and invested in films as well. And they looked at the script. Admittedly, it wasn't the same script as what eventually got made as The Dish, you know, whatever, 10 years later. But they said, oh, no, it's just, yeah, no, it's not quite right. You guys should stick to telly. We didn't get upset about it. Mind you, we still got that letter. That letter sits up on our wall. But we said, let's make a practice movie. Let's make it cheap. How much money have we got? Let's go to Kodak. This is the film we got. Let's do it. Let's learn. And then they came back, the same distributors came back and said, oh, can we give you a bit more money to complete the film? Because we hadn't shot any of the exteriors or anything yet. And then it became a thing. But even when it came out as a film, it wasn't immediately successful. It stayed on the charts almost an entire year. Back in the days when if it didn't work in the first 2 weeks, you could still stay there. And eventually it sort of kicked in. So it made a bit at the box office. Then television stations were interested in the film because it had become a bit of a phenomenon. And then I think the film really took off on TV. You know, when people talk about it's Australia's most loved movie or all that, because of television, not because of cinema. I mean, Crocodile Dundee was a cinema sensation. Strictly Ballroom and, you know, Muriel's Wedding, they were cinema sensations. Kenny was and everything. But I think that The Castle grew on TV, which, again, does that make it a bit more Italian?
Certainly that relationship with TV.
TV in Italy is massive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And a lot of Italians still watch a lot of, movies on TV.
I mean, perhaps not so much right now because of streaming, but 10, 20 years ago, were you going to make a film in Italy if you didn't think it had a TV life? I mean, probably not.
I
think now with streaming, it's loosened things up a little bit.
Yeah.
But then you're not going to make anything that's not going to stream. No, of course not. So we're thinking that this film, The Castle, which, Santa's being modest, is a huge cultural phenomenon in this country. you know, was perhaps made because they're trying to get another film made. So it's not the reason for the season, yet no. It has become. And you know, I'll say it, I prefer The Dish. I think The Dish is one of the great films.
So do I.
Anyone's made.
I love it, The Dish.
But the idea that The Castle is the only reason we got The Dish, and, you know, not the
but
only reason.
But don't you think that's a beautiful
story?
There
were
so many
story.
Happy accidents. There are so many great happy accidents.
Absolutely.
And it's also maybe the film we needed to make because it is genuinely a tribute to all the writers' families. It's a genuine tribute.
Yeah.
When we first showed the movie at a little cinema in Richmond just to see whether people actually got it or laughed or whatever, there were big laughs and at the same time there were these little oohs and ahs going, oh, that's literally our conversation. That's us, you know. And you could hear them from different parts of the cinema because it was like the Chilaro family had some oohs, the Kennedys did, you know.
Did anyone get cranky?
No, not at all.
But to me, it's really very interesting because also, in a way, shows what it's like to make a film maybe without that pressure of a production.
Yes.
And that really ties back into with the Italian filmmaking, you know, because a lot of the, you know, great directors, you think of Fellini or Rossellini, they did... You know, they were auteur. They wanted to make a film as they wanted without too much interference. And I think this film maybe fits in with this idea. You know, we are going to make it. We don't have this huge pressure from a lot of investment in money and you're really working on something that you believe in.
Well, maybe it's why Marcello Mastroianni never made it in Hollywood because maybe there was either too much pressure that, you know, he was going to be the next big thing. You know, he was going to be the male version of Sophia Loren and possibly the films that he was in there was pressure on them. And then all of a sudden comes back to Italy and is even a bigger star than what he was because he's working with people that are having lunches in the middle of Tuscany when they have a break during the day and life is okay when you're making films.
Yeah, and that really, you know, it's a little bit the story of the Sica, you know, with Ladri di Biciclette, Bicycle Thieves, that he says, the American production got in and they wanted, Selznick was involved and they wanted to, him to sign a contract for 7 films. And he said, no, I'm not in for something like that. This is not the film I want to make. And in fact, he refused. And that would have been a lot of money.
That freedom is exactly why Ingrid Bergman goes to Italy because she wants to make films in this way. What interesting, I'm just thinking about when you're making this film, Nanni Moretti is making Caro Diario and Aprile.
Okay.
Both of which are kind of like things will go where I want them to go.
Caro Diario, especially.
That freedom, which I think is really important. And that concept, and to an artist, as we saw with Ingrid Bergman in the 50s and later on with Marcello when he comes back and whatever, is absolutely gold. The other thing that I'm thinking of a lot in terms of trying to understand that local cultural appreciation of the film is the comparison with Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Right.
And hey, you know, that sort of variety style comic things, you know, and when they're watching the best of Hey Hey It's Saturday.
There's only one show better than Hey Hey It's Saturday, and that's the best of Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Yeah. And Michael Caton sitting there, you know, genuinely like seems to be cracking up. Dongham Red. But the kind of I remember when Hey Hey It's Saturday ended and we talked about this, someone asked me to talk about it and I thought that the variety format, the thing where anything could happen, that sense of live TV and all that stuff, which I think there's a sense of that to me in your film.
Hey Hey It's Saturday, to me, again, the Italian part of that was, it was basically a bunch of people just saying, hey, it's just television. It's, you know what I mean? It's not a high form of art. It's just television. It's a Saturday night. It's 6:30. You're about to go out and have a good time anyway. Does it really matter whether we're lowbrow or anything? And I guess it was the same with The Castle. It was like, really? I mean, this is not an art house film. In fact, in America, they tried to market it as an art house film and it just didn't work that way.
Social document.
Yes, it's ridiculous. They didn't know how to market it, you know? Harvey Weinstein and Miramax took it and they just did. They loved the film, but they didn't know how to market it. It went really well at the
Sundance.
The Sundance.
Yeah, and then there was a bidding war and then they didn't know how to market it. They just didn't know where it sat. And I can sort of understand that in a way. It's a slightly confusing film because if you were American, you wouldn't understand it. In fact, we changed some of the lines for the Americans.
Okay. Yeah.
A friend of ours, Harry Shearer, who's a great performer, he changed because obviously, you know, things like rissoles or whatever that don't exist, and the types of cars and things like that don't exist. So we changed those things and changed them quite well.
To just change tack a little bit, there is a sense that this film is about migrant experience. You know, fairly stereotypical skip family, but there's so much to me about the potential for, you know, second, third generation experience of migrant, that is.
If you had to remake the film, it'd be pretty interesting because you could choose any ethnicity, any class. Well, no, not any class, but it didn't have to be a white Australian blue collar family.
Did it at the time?
It's funny because it could have been anything at the time, but we're just saying, well, that's what the story is. So don't read anything into it. It just happens to be about a white family.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's, you know, what is it with Wogs and Cash? And, you know, there's Farouk. There's a bit of that going on. But, and again, there's a bit of unashamed kind of like, not xenophobia, but it's just sort of like, as a kid, I used to watch a Kingswood Country or something, and they'd have these, or even Paul Hogan and, you know, Keeper Dancing Maria, Luigi the Unbelievable. And I knew that it was stereotype stuff, but I felt privileged because I felt included. I felt, oh, okay, so I'm part of the fabric, so therefore someone can make fun of my, you know, the things that I do. Whereas you now have to be a lot more careful. And probably at the time, someone could have pointed that out to me going, you do realize you're just laughing at a cliche. And then I would have thought, no, that's not the best thing. But it was interesting that my first instinct was that it was being inclusive.
Yeah. But I think that the film does reveal a society that is much more multicultural than, you know, an Italian society would be. Now I'm thinking how interesting it would have been to see, you know, the kind of setting that would have used for the Italian version, you know, the kind of house, what kind of neighbours.
Yeah.
So that would be quite interesting. And also where they would set it.
Yes.
You know,
where do you see it in your head now?
I don't know. I can tell you where I set it in my head.
It was at the, I think it's called Punto Raisi, which is the airport in Palermo.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because it's the airport in Palermo is right next to houses. It's literally right next to houses. And so... And it's got nothing to do with the fact that I have Sicilian background. I thought that would be the area to do it because let's not forget that the whole thing about the castle was that when Dale talks about the place, it was supposed to be a hub. The street was supposed to be a big street. They were going to set up all these things, but it all fell through.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So to me, the whole thing about Italy and the false dawn of what Europe was going to do to Italy, you know, Palermo was going to be a hub for all of Europe. Everyone would travel through Palermo and it never got up.
Yeah.
And so therefore there's that sort of illusion that something is going to big happen here, but it just, you know what, it doesn't happen. And he wasn't going to have greyhounds. He was going to have racing pigeons.
Okay.
I think that racing pigeons would have been also better metaphors for flying free.
Exactly.
But I think the kind of sense of everyone being able to look at this family and I mean I'm really also interested in the fact that we're talking about a comedy. I think that's really key. I mean, film comedy in Australia is quite rare. You know, there's more and more, but the comedies are always films that do the best. They're A Weird Mob, we haven't even mentioned yet, but is definitely part of this.
It's a film that I idolized growing up, absolutely idolized. I think you're absolutely right. It's in the context of a comedy. Let's not forget it's a comedy. If it was just a completely humorless film, I think it would just would have been silly. It would have been just laughable. Yeah. People laugh at it, but I'm saying it's
at it rather than with it.
Yes. But here's the weird irony, and that is that the hardest work we had to do editing the film was getting rid of jokes. There were too many jokes. We just said, it has to have a heart, it has to have a story, and if that joke doesn't further the story, it's just got to go.
Mm.
And we learnt to murder so many darlings. There were really good jokes that went by the wayside because we would look at that and say, but yeah, that's a bit of a sugar hit. That is a funny joke, but that ultimately damages Daryl's character. Daryl would not do that. He would not say that. He would not do that. The kids would not do that. And we are undermining the film if we do that.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be really easy to talk about this as an Italian film if it was just written by Santo Cilauro. But, you know, he has some others who kind of do stuff.
It certainly wasn't. It certainly wasn't. Well, that's interesting too, because there are so many Italian films that are collaborations, not necessarily with writing the actual script, but surely, you know, I know Tornatore and Morricone are clearly very close in terms of what they create for the screen. And they worked for months and if not years before they even shoot anything. So that whole world of collaboration. Now, we worked as a genuine collaboration on this one here. So it was written by myself, Rob Sitch, Tom Glasner, and Jane Kennedy. We had been writing together for quite a few years, just on television. But we thought that the way to do it, and it was so important. We felt, and it turned out being a blessing that we actually did follow through with it. And that is that. Once we realized that it was going to be a story about our own families, we said, oh, you know, Jane, what about the fact that Ray does this whenever, and Rob, you know, the way Charlie compliments your mum and Santa, your dad, and that's as a solicitor, all that kind of thing. Once we knew that there were going to be enough stories there, a couple of us, Rob Sitch and I, just said, okay, Tom, Jane, you keep away from the script now. We'll become the custodian of this script now. We're not going to spend months on it. We're not going to spend weeks on it, but we will spend, you know, 10 to 14 days of really nutting out a spine. The dominoes. This happens, then that happens, then that happens, and that happens. Let's not worry too much about jokes. You can write jokes right up until the day before shooting. There's never any problems about that. It's what happens next. So Rob and I laid siege to it, worked out a spine, a very simple spine, worked on certain characters. You can't help but put in jokes when the character starts suggesting those jokes to you, and you just put them down. You're just basically a mouthpiece for them. And then Tom and Jane, a couple of weeks later, just read our script. We probably would have done maybe only two or three drafts by then. And then that's so important that they had fresh eyes, because they would just look at it and go, oh my God, that's great. That's terrible. Whatever it is. So those fresh eyes really, really are so instructive, as important as literally writing down the story. So then we probably would have got back, started writing it again, and then gone through that process for about maybe 10 or 11 drafts. We usually do that many drafts. And as I said before, the more you write, the stronger the characters become, and the more prolific you get with the jokes, because all of a sudden people say, who wrote the vibe line? Who said, oh, it's the vibe? And I honestly, I may have written it down on paper or whatever, but it was Dennis DeNuto that wrote that line. The character wrote that line. So that's where I credit my love for Pirandello, the fact that characters come alive. Characters become more important than real people. They become more real than real people. So that was the way in which we wrote the film. Mm. And in terms of editing, I think it was pretty simply edited. There was hardly anything that we shot that didn't make the film. We just didn't have that luxury. So the editing process wasn't that difficult. It was the storyboard.
There are two soundtracks.
Yes.
As I understand it.
There's an American soundtrack. So,
which is orchestral.
Which is magnificent. Yeah. So Jane Kennedy went over to the United States and because we didn't have a soundtrack. I think it was just commercial music and a couple of, we got the rights to, I think, a Paul Kelly song, which he agreed to, and Kate Sobrano, I think it was a Carpenter song at the end, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was a Carpenter song.
We've Only Just Begun, is it?
We've Only Just Begun. We've Only Just Begun by Kate Sobrano singing a Carpenter song. But when we went to the United States, they gave us a budget for a proper soundtrack, and Jane met a wonderful composer, Korean composer called Ed Choi. And he ended up doing the music for The Dish, which is a masterpiece, I reckon. It's magnificent music.
Did Jane cast it?
Yeah, she's a casting genius. In fact, the person that we had secured to play the part of Daryl Kerrigan, he came in to talk to us about the part, and Rob and I thought that he was great, and he is. He's no longer with us. He was a wonderful actor. He was belittling the film just a little. He was a little bit patronizing about the fact that it was such a small film, which we thought, fair enough, it is a small film. We just got into the office after he left, and our entire office, which is made up entirely and still is basically of very sensitive and very sensible females, they're not stupid like us. They basically came up and said, right. And we said, how good was he? And it was there was a bit of, oh, yeah. Oh, what? No, he was good. What is he not right? And then there was a bit of shaking of the head going, well, I don't know. Really? Is that guy going to really, is he going to, because everything we did is very sort of, we're like a family. We only work with people that we really want to work with. And in the end, Jane Kennedy came in at the end of the day and she said, look, you know what? Let me fly up to Sydney. I want to talk to Michael Caton. We said, Michael Caton, who was on The Sullivans.
That's
and,
a huge.
And who'd been going yeah. through a very bad mm. trot. Anyway, so he met with Jane and basically said to Jane, this role was made for me. This will change my life. Jane came back and said, you know, I think he's the guy. And we literally had to tell the other guy, you know, we've changed our mind, which was very difficult for us. But thank God that happened. And it was Jane. Jane got on a plane that day, was going to wait for the next day. But Michael said, no. I'll if you take the punt on me, I'll take this straight away.
His character in The Sullivans, which was a huge cultural phenomenon in its massive. Day, that was training for this role. I mean, his character was... You know, the uncle, his name was Uncle Harry. Yeah. He was a rough diamond, heart of gold. Everything was always off the back of a truck, but, you know, it was okay. And he, the heart of gold thing is really, so it made complete sense to those of us of that generation who knew that character.
Yes.
Definitely.
And certainly with Bud Tingwell, Bud had just lost his wife and they were inseparable. She was a magnificent lady. We love her, you know, to this day. And I remember we contacted his son to say, we would love Bud to play a role with us, but we would never dare to ask him if he's in a bad place at the moment. And the son said, no, I think that this could be the best thing that can happen to him. So he was so happy to do it. And I think he brought a lot of the emotion that he had in his performance. A lot of that came because of what had just happened to him in the recent past. So we were just very lucky with both those guys. They were both, you know, enormous pillars in the film. And I wonder, I don't know enough about Italian cinema to know whether they're the kind of decisions that get made by Italian directors. My gut tells me yes.
Yeah.
Gut tells me that
probably. Yeah,
that they would look at someone and say, you know what, can we have a coffee together? Because I think that I know that you mightn't be right for this part, but... You want to give it a go.
As opposed to, yeah. you know, we've got to have a board meeting with seven guys in suits and everyone's got to agree that Michael Caton yeah. is the right thing. I mean, how do you don't get Caton through that process.
No, absolutely
you're
not.
Get Sam Neill.
Yeah.
But which, you know, we all love Sam, but it wouldn't have worked.
Well, I don't know, Mark, I don't know if we have been able to demonstrate that this is a really Australian film, but I have to admit that it's got maybe an Italian vibe. Can we say that?
In fact, you can only say that Italian vibe because how would you say the Italian vibe in Italian?
How do we translate the
senso di italianità, but that does not translate well at all. And so maybe it is an Australian film after all because you can't translate the vibe.
Can you translate Tell Him He's Dreaming?
Sta sognando. But then again, it doesn't. Yeah, and it's the same as the serenity. You know, I wonder how the serenity. I don't know. That would have been, you know, a hell of a job for a translator to try to find, you know, the exact Italian for this.
You know, there are so many kind of key words that we now use from, you know, the vibe is one that's
absolutely.
Going straight to the pool room. What's with Wogs and Cash?
What is it with Wogs and Cash?
You know, there are many of them. And I, you know, watching again last night, seeing we say these things all the time.
They have really entered the Australian vocabulary.
Definitely.
In Australia, if someone says, look at me, already you're going, look at me.
Yes.
It's because of the characters. It's not because of the line. So therefore, I think it's Daryl Kerrigan resonates. So how's the serenity? And or Dennis DeNudo says, it's the vibe of the thing. It's because you go, I love that guy and how he said that. Yeah. It doesn't exist as words. It exists as words from a character's mouth.
Yeah. Mm. No, that's right. That's right. In an Italian setting, there would have been the additional complication of, you know, where is it set and what is the regional accent and what is the actual dialect of that particular place. And that creates another dimension, I would say, of the story, especially if it is looked at, you know, from another region perspective. So
it's so in many ways, you would just set it either in Milano or Bologna or somewhere, just so that you're basically saying.
But then you are setting it in the north instead of the south. So any kind of decision that you make in the setting, I think, in a way, it influences how you are narrating that particular story.
I'm getting an idea for another bonus podcast. I want us to understand whether The Castle is a Melbourne film as opposed to being a Sydney film.
Oh, wow. Maybe.
We went to the Actor Awards this year, where we were given some kind of Lifetime Achievement Award, and we had some forums in Queensland, and they were big forums. It didn't feel like...
That's because they're full of people moving north.
From Melbourne, exactly. Full of Mexicans.
Yeah, no, but it's done well on Nine, this
film.
It's
done very well on Nine,
Implies a certain idea of Australian national across borders.
There was early criticism from papers like The Australian, and even there was a film reviewer called Jim Shembury. I'm quite happy to say that, because he was very, very gracious afterwards. He said, I got it wrong. Evan Williams from The Australian said, I got it wrong. David Stratton, quite famously, said, you know what, I got it wrong. But to me, the most heartwarming comment I ever got about The Castle was going to the Warrandyte Cemetery to visit my father-in-law's grave. And I went to take my little son, he was little at the time, we went for a walk, and there was a grave there, and it said, I'll never forget it, Barry Big Baz Fromono, age 34, how's the serenity?
Oh, that was beautiful.
Yeah. We sued.
You lawyer up. But it was,
did you win?
I went all the way to the High Court. It was the greatest compliment. You can't ask for a bigger compliment.
No, absolutely not.
Well, perhaps on that note, we can bring our discussion to an end.
Why not?
Well, thank you so much, Santo, for conversation.
I learned a lot about the castle that I didn't actually know myself.
All right, thank you. Yeah, it's good. You have been listening to Chop Tops and Cassata, an episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our producer and editor, Alice Garner. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Horwood Recording Studio by Gavin Nabel. It is a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. Chop Tops and Cassata would not be possible without the support of the Australasian Centre for Italian Studies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons.